Good morning.
Hello.
So today we're going to talk about impact benefit agreements. And while this might sound like a really uninteresting financial kind of topic, let me assure you it's one of the most interesting areas that's occurring outside the observation of just about everyone, including people participating in it. It's a very intriguing area of work. It's where a lot of negotiations are actually occurring, and it's probably the pivotal point of assimilation that's occurring in Indigenous communities today, I would suggest to you. But before I begin with this topic, I just wanted to know if you had any questions about the issue on treaties, on the topic on treaties that we talked about last day, which is looking at treaties since the establishment of the BC Treaty Commission. Any points of clarification, specific observations, or questions on that subject? Yeah?
What's the source of the existing band
What's the source or the origin of the lands now held as band lands? So those, in general speaking, they go back to a series of land commissions and processes done in the 1880s and 90s. Some of those reserves weren't actually legally finalized till around World War II, in fact. So even though they were surveyed, so Peter O'Reilly, the Lands Commissioner of British Columbia in the 1780s and 90s, went up and down the coast through the interior, accompanied with an entourage of surveyors. Sometimes the surveyors went afterwards, sometimes they were with him. He negotiated a whole series of reservations or reserves for First Nations communities, and then they were surveyed out. And there was a whole process of allocating land and reserving land for use by Indigenous communities. His blogs and notebooks and journals, which are available to review through the archives, often provide some very interesting descriptions of who was at the meetings. So he would name, so for example, a meeting at Low Inlet in Kakatla Territory in 1891, he describes met with Sheikhs, Paul Sabasa, and 23 other chiefs. And then goes on to describe the meeting and what reserves are set out, and then later on is the surveyor's notes. And of course the surveyor himself then records very detailed measurements of the layout of these reserves. But they would incorporate information on what kind of resources, whether they're mineral, agricultural, forestry, fisheries. But then there's a whole sequence of cutoffs that occurred. Does anyone ever go shopping in Park Royal? No? Really? Yes. I mean, you don't have to deny it. It's quite likely that some of you, at least some of the time, I know. Anyway, the southern part of Park Royal is cut off reserve land from Squamish that in a court case some years ago was returned to Squamish, which is why if you have a status card, it's all tax free for sales tax on the south side, but not on the north side. These little anomalies of Canadian taxation laws at play. Also in Prince Rupert, there was a big cutoff. What sits the port, Prince Rupert sits on, but it amounted to a cutoff reserve land that was sliced away around the early 1910s, around World War I. Douglas Cole has a really nice book to focus on the fisheries, though. It's called Landing Native Fisheries. But in that book, he talks about the process of setting up fishery reserves, particularly on the coast, but targeted for fisheries, and he outlines in very nice detail that process of reserve formation. His father, incidentally, Cole Harris, has a book, which I can't remember, unfortunately, the name of his most recent book, which looks at the issue in a somewhat different dynamic, but also in some detail. So that's the background for how that was worked out. Any other questions related to treaties? Okay. So today we're going to talk about impact benefit agreements. And there's three general areas I want to focus on. What purpose do they serve? I want to give you an example of them. I'll give one in particular and I'll mention a couple others. And then talk about the implications of these agreements. Sometimes they're called economic benefit agreements. Sometimes they're called benefit sharing agreements. Or they're often where they emerged in prominence in Canada in the mining industry, impact benefit agreements. The mining industry in the Northwest Territories and the northern part of Canada has actually been the forefront of creating these to one extent to deal with the legislative framework in Nunavut and Northwest Territories that actually requires certain types of benefit agreements in place, but also to ensure they at least had some degree of support in the outside the specific mining interest. Mining is an industry that often generates intense community, broad-spread community opposition, even as it provides high wages and often economic benefits. In BC, for example, mining is one of the biggest things in BC. One of the lessons the resource industries have learned over the course of the green revolution, as it were, starting in the 1970s, is they needed to find allies that could work in the PR regime. And so they learned very quickly that forming benefit agreements with First Nations really worked well for their PR departments. The question becomes, do they work well for First Nations? And that's part of what we're going to look at here. So I want to look at the purposes. Now here, I am pulling directly from, because I want to try to give an industry-centered explanation of the purpose of these things. So this is the same, if you look at, for example, Woodward & Company, which is a legal firm based in Victoria, one of the leaders in Aboriginal rights and title litigation in the province of British Columbia, if not Canada. They have a document on their website that describes a kind of work handbook for achieving an appropriate and fair benefit sharing agreement, which is the same thing as impact benefit agreement. On a website called miningfacts.org is another nice summary of benefits agreement, this time put forward by the industry proponents inside, and there's a lot of confluence. And then if you scan through a number of First Nations, such as Haisla Nation, that has a listing of projects they're engaged in, you won't find their impact benefit agreements, but you'll find mentioning as a positive outcome of these agreements the same ideas that you see here. So, one of the key things is this idea of reducing delays. As the legal precedence has mounted, it's become clearer and clearer that proponents, either acting on behalf of government or government itself, has to engage in negotiations and discussions. They have to engage in what's called meaningful consultation with First Nations. Now, there's been a lot of ink spilt and cork dollars spent on defining what constitutes meaningful consultation, but let me sum it up by saying it takes a long time. Because it's community specific, it has to be documented, and it means that there's a certain extent to which the First Nation can move slowly. It's always an irksome issue for the government when the First Nation has no clear central authority to make decisions. Many First Nations don't have clear central authorities to make decisions because the nature of governance in Indigenous communities tends to be dispersed and lateral. whereas the companies want concentrated and hierarchical. So when you bring a concentrated system of power, hierarchically arranged, into contact with a dispersed, laterally arranged system of power, it really kind of slows the system down. There's also a widespread belief amongst proponents, which is sometimes true but often not true, that First Nations are deliberately slowing things down. And I say it's often not true because it's part of me. How do you organize when you say have 25 hereditary leaders who have each with them a network of five to ten named people with positions in their house group, plus a wider array of people around that, and you have to bring each of those parties to consensus, perhaps before you even meet with the company. So what the companies have realized is that, okay, often this gets bogged down, this process. Let's see if we can kind of invest a bit of money up front to speed things up. And the way you invest money up front to speed things up is you enter into a benefit agreement, and you try to do it in a way that you're without prejudice to your rights of title, without prejudice to any future discussions, or even sometimes the companies will agree, like Enbridge did in a couple cases. Enbridge, the Northern Gateway, agreed to fund capacity operations with various First Nations without compelling that First Nation to be in support of the project. However, when Enbridge then did its PR stuff, they talked about all these First Nations that had signed agreements with them, and they conveniently left off the fact that there was those agreements did not imply support, but in many of the cases they merely were agreements to have capacity funding to hire consultants to read the thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of technical reports produced by Enbridge for the joint review panel process to approve that document. Okay. Reducing delay. So this is one thing that they all talk about, all the documents talk about, you speed things up, move forward, because of course in a market economy, the slower you go at something, potentially anyway, this is what it said, the slower you go, the higher your cost, because you kind of build an accumulating cost on all the capital that you've borrowed to build your project. And so this becomes part of the cost of doing business. The other often cited item is to mitigate impacts. Now, these impacts can be a range of things, and here I'm just going to focus on, so for example, impacts on the community. So one of the things with the LNG plants that are being put forward in Prince Rupert, and there's about five or six or seven of these gigantic things are being discussed, whether we see one or two of them, it really remains to be seen. And I just say, I think, it's one of those things where you've heard it enough over the years. So way back in the late 60s, 70s, they talked about an LNG plant in Prince Rupert, and then it disappeared. Then in the 80s, and it disappeared in the 90s, and disappeared. Now we're moving on 20, 30 years later. Of course, they might just actually do it. You never know. There's a lot of work going on with it. But one of the things that have been raised about building these plants with the thousands of workers that are going to come into Prince Rupert and Port Edward, and the building of work camps, these disposable camps, they pop them up with portable buildings, and then they pop them down, is the worry about the socioeconomic impacts on First Nations communities. So the economic benefit agreements, almost to a letter, discuss in some way providing kind of social service and assistance type supports, which is a kind of bizarre way of saying that they anticipate the influx of 3,000 to 6,000 to 9,000 predominantly men will cause a massive social disruption in the community. So that's some of the impacts. There's also environmental impacts. Mitigations of the environmental impacts are often included. just read one. Then this word certainty. Yet again, we mentioned it the other day, talked about treaties, certainty, and this is about ground rules. Because very often these contracts include a kind of non-compliance clause in it. I.e., if you don't comply with the agreement, the agreement is broken. And by compliance, it basically means the First Nation is often encumbered in such a way that they cannot challenge the project. So once they actually sign on a benefit agreement, they are typically locked in, so they are unable to actually challenge in any meaningful way without losing the funding to the benefit agreement. This is the standard, this is the typical model in which these things take place. Because what the companies want is that, and especially as larger the capital investment becomes, the more interested they are in this kind of thing. So this, in a sense, there appears to be two ranges. Now this requires, it's hard to actually check this, two kind of points. When you have a, so I got three things I need to say here about the 2 points, and then why is it a problem to make a comment on this. It appears that at the lower end of scale, at the small business, local, regional business side, there's a lot of interest because those guys have sunk their entire shirt, as it were, in the home, their home, they mortgaged the home, etc. And so that small-scale local businessman who's entered into an impact benefit agreement with the First Nation has a heck of a feel to say about a lot to lose, and they really want to make sure that once they sign this agreement that they're going to get support. And then at the top end, where there's this massive, you know, we're talking billions of dollars, that these companies don't want some local First Nation going off the deep end and then disrupting their program. And now that sounds really inappropriately worded and facetious, but literally, when you sit down with these guys, this is the way in which they consider it. If they're going to sign in an agreement with, say, hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars with the First Nation, and they're investing billions, they want to make sure their billions are protected. So they don't want you going over the edge and criticizing after you signed an agreement.
Is this where they were taking down the government and the capital, or the
Yeah. These type of agreements are very similar to whether they're government or private industry. The government ones are a little bit easier to get access to, which comes to my third point. It's hard to make these direct observations because these agreements are locked down under confidentiality agreements mostly, and you only see them when somebody breaks the clause and hands it to the press, or when it bubbles out from a community in some way, or where you see the noted outcomes being posted on different web pages. Very, very few of these agreements are out there. Or you find them in the templates, so not the actual signed agreements, but the templates, such as, say, Woodward and Company's handbook includes a number of templates for what impact benefit agreement should look like. And so you'll get these kind of interspersing documents. So it's hard to actually say, and of course I made this assertion that at the low end, the high end seems to be the most desire to have these compliance clauses put in place. And it seems that somewhere in the middle range, it appears not to be quite the same. But again, that's only because the publicly available data is hard, and I would be inclined to suggest that it's similar across the board. It's just that when you look at what you can see out there, it seems to suggest that there's more interest at the top end and the small and the bottom end of the outside proponents. One of the other mitigating impacts, which comes under addressing infringement of rights and title, and this is the area in which private corporations have picked up the responsibility of the Crown. So a whole sequence of court decisions, but in particular the sequence of the Haida court decisions against the Crown over forestry, has defined this need to consult, but it's allowed the Crown to essentially hand off Crown's responsibility to consultation to the proponent. Now, it's a funny thing, and it's still the Crown's responsibility to engage in meaningful consultation, but the way in which the court decisions have come and the way the practice emerged, the companies often end up carrying the stick, as it were, for the government on this matter. Now, that has some interesting outcomes. If it was the government that was engaged in negotiating infringements of rights and title, I suspect it wouldn't be focused so much upon number of jobs and training programs. Could be wrong. But the government, but it would be a different type of issue. But here in the impact benefit agreements, infringement of rights and title is addressed by providing communities with employment, with training operations, sometimes with funding for educational programs. For example, De Beers has a number of scholarship type and fellowship programs for training, but it's fairly constrained. They actually control it through a joint trust model. They have to be very careful because these agreements do not actually resolve rights and title questions. They can't. And there's a whole debate about whether these documents really have any solid legal rights. Some of the documentation literature call these quasi-legal agreements. And that strikes me as a really kind of nerve-wracking kind of sound. A quasi-legal agreement is essentially what the legal profession tends to call these things. Which means that what that suggests that at some point they're potentially open to challenge under some kind of constitutional framework or other legal avenue. And that perhaps the companies are essentially trying to address the infringements of rights and title are taking on a mandate of government that they don't legally hold. Hard to say. But this little chart here just shows the increase from, I believe that date is 1988, zero, up to a big bump around 2010, and dropped off a little bit. But just to say, those are a number of agreements signed per year. Yeah?
Do the companies prefer this way of doing this, or?
I think it's hard to answer. My sense is they preferred over the alternative. And because the alternative is essentially a bit of chaos and disruption and not really knowing when they might be sued, and they actually see it a way of locking down a type of support.
Because they have more control over
Yeah. And often it's referred to now in this kind of interesting term, social license. And the guys would talk about purchasing and securing social license. Like people work for the companies use this language. Social license is used in the environmental movement and the public movement as like this positive thing. You have to win social license. I have a lot of qualms with that terminology because it really seems to reside upon a kind of market mentality. And especially when the company side are talking about securing and purchasing, it seems to emphasize some of the potential drawbacks. Now, from the industrial proponent side, this is seen to be a major step forward. There are a range of different models were attempted before. If you look in BC, so-called war in the woods between environmental movements and logging in the 1980s in particular, the initial model that moved forward were things like joint venture logging companies. So up in the north coast of British Columbia, West Fraser Timber was engaged in harvesting old growth timber out of little creek valleys. And they wanted to avoid the limelight of environmental oversight. And so they formed a joint venture with Lac Aux Lambs to go into a place called Chalmers Creek and then harvest the 300 plus old trees without as the same kind of observations. Yeah? You had a question? No, oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. So, one of the ways in the 1980s it was happening was this whole development of joint venture, and very often the forest company, what they would do is move into a framework of saying, we'll provide you with a 50% equity and employment and a set minimum number of employment, proportion of employment for these areas. And oftentimes the areas that became targeted for the joint venture operations were the ones that were the biggest flashpoints in terms of the predominantly urban-based environmental movement. And then what you would end up happening is you'd get this reframement, it's an advancement from the 1970s where the companies would talk about jobs versus the environment. Well, now the companies were being just as environmentally sound as everybody else. The timber was certified. It was recognized as being sustainable timber. They had First Nations joint venture partners. They had First Nations community members harvesting the timber. And they would then say to the environmentalists, you know, we're ahead of the game here on what it is to be an environmentalist in terms of how to go about this. It was, for a while, quite an effective program. But then as the rights argument in the court started to click forward in advance, it became clear that those activities themselves were insufficient to maintain access to the resources. And income benefit arrangements, when you start seeing clicking up here in the 2000s, especially after 2008, this is really coming after some of the Haida court cases, defining consultations involvement, some of the refinements, and also moving into the big expansion of fracking in the northeast part of BC and some of the expansion of the mineral developments that are occurring. So it becomes more and more important for them to get this kind of support, and also because of, from the proponents' side, the industrial proponents' side, this lack of certainty over whether they might be interrupted by a rights and title case. And there's been a number of very significant court wins in these areas which have propelled them forward, and so they figure it's cheaper to sign an agreement than to waste the time, spend the time in the courts and the cost of the courts, especially when they might lose anyway in the court. So let's take a look at an example. Here we have a provincial minister, a federal minister, a chief counselor of a First Nation, and the CEO of a major energy company, all on a federal government-sponsored action plan public announcement. So this is one of the models that have been used in the resource areas of the province of British Columbia. This is around an announcement of an agreement with Apache, which is Kitimat LNG, which is in joint partnership with Chevron, and also is oriented towards sending. They have a number of holdings up in the northeast of BC, and they have what's it called? What's their pipeline called? I forget which pipe. I mean, there's about five or six. Well, let's just say four to six pipelines that are going to crisscross northern BC from the gas fields in northeast BC and Alberta. Two or so, I believe, come out in Kitimat, and the one or two come out by Alice Arm in the northern, just which is north of Nass River, and then there's three or four planned to come out around Prince Rupert. So there's a range of these things. So this is a model, and what you see is the Haisla. Now the Haisla has been very prominently opposed to Enbridge in the shipment of tar sands. And at the same time as opposing the expansion of the tar sands transportation, they have been very supportive of the liquid natural gas, LNG, processing and shipment. On their own webpage, they describe how, as opposed to the catastrophic destruction of a tar sands carrier, an LNG carrier would merely, the gas could explode and evaporate and would not therefore cause the same kind of environmental impact. I'm not an environmental scientist, so I really can't comment if that's true. There's part of me in my gut feeling, which is always be cautious about trusting one's gut, but my gut feeling is I can't believe that it really isn't, there isn't some environmental impact of blowing up an LNG tanker when it crashes, say, into Gill Island in the coast, which the Queen of the North, the ferry which did and went down and took two lives, and it's still sitting on the bottom because it's too deep, dangerous, and expensive for them to actually get the bunker sea and the fuel that's on it off of it. Anyway, so the Haisla have entered into a whole range of agreements. They've leased land for facilities. They've entered into a joint venture partnership, which is being funded by the provincial and federal governments in the pipeline transmission company, so they'll have a kind of joint equity share in that. they will have to derive economic benefits to pay for their, they'll have to pay their loans back, so it's not like money that they're given or an equity share. They are borrowing, the federal government's going to lend it to them, and once the pipelines get up and running, they then have to pay it back at the same rate of return that you would in any market economy. I'll just read a quote from the website here about, and I have to say that this, the actual specifics of this agreement are not publicly available. And the information I have is only that which is available on the website, which anyone can actually see. And any information that I may have, I wouldn't be able to share because I would be bound by any kind of confidentiality agreement. So, quote, the proposed Kitimat LNG facility will be built on land leased under a unique benefit agreement with the Haisla Nation. The facility will include two liquefaction trains. Those are the plant facilities produce that transform the gas into a transportable object. It actually liquefies to put it onto the boats. Trains to cool the natural gas to a liquid state. LNG storage tanks and a marine jetty and a berth to accommodate specialized LNG carriers. Kitimat LNG has a National Energy Board license to export up to 10 million tons of LNG per year. Natural gas will be delivered to the facility by the proposed 480-kilometer Pacific Trail Pipeline. Oh, that's the word, the name I was looking for, Pacific Trail Pipeline, from Summit Lake, B.C. to Kitimat. 16 First Nations along the proposed natural gas pipeline route have signed the innovative First Nations Limited Partnership Agreement, which will deliver specific economic as well as employment training and contracting benefits to First Nations for the lifetime of the project. The First Nations Limited Partnership ensures First Nations receive benefits and have direct access to the economic opportunities presented by the proposed Kitimat LNG project. And then the benefits are listed. To date, over 1,600 First Nations trained through the PTP Aboriginal Skills to Employment Partnership, which is a federally funded program. So when business says that they're making it all on their own, please keep note that this is actually Canadian tax dollars that are being spent to train people to work for these large conglomerates, which are mostly non-Canadian owned. Over 900 PTP ACEP trainees have found jobs. So that's a little bit better than 50%. They don't tell us the nature of these jobs. 380,000 PTP construction hours to First Nations workers. 245 million in and on it goes, listing these kind of documents. Construction expenditures to First Nations contractors. Financial payments to First Nations LP members. Kind of partnership agreement. And approximately of the liquefied natural gas plant construction to date, about 85% of the spending has been awarded to Haisla Nation businesses. Okay, and then it goes on to talk more. So in these documents, in these agreements, what's being highlighted are, first of all, economic benefits through equity joint ownership. So that's the idea of saying, here, we're going to give you a partner. It's very standard. I've been at meetings where I've seen, for example, in Kakatla, where, say, back about 10 years ago, where wind power companies came in and were offering everything to is there a proportion of transmission pipeline companies, to the transmission, the operating company. And what they typically do is, so it might be one front agency that's running the group, but then the whole thing is subdivided into a range of smaller segment companies. So it's quite an interesting study in and of itself how these companies operate. So it's not just like Chevron. So if you've got Kitimat LNG, which is set up as a separate company apart from the companies that own it. And then you have a private transportation company to move the oil that's owned by these guys, but it's separate from it. The operation of the plant is separate. The people who are going to operate the marine loading terminal is a separate plant, a separate facility. And then they provide to the First Nations equity shares in different portions of this base, and then you get profit, you know, a portion of the profit. The other interesting notion, the equity arrangements typically include payout of profit. And for anyone who's worked in finances or related to corporations knows that the issue between revenue and profit is a world apart. You might have lots of revenue and no profit. So oftentimes agreements based upon profit really don't pan out for the signatories of these agreements. they would be better off taking percentages of revenue flow than profit realized. Then the other thing that's often offered is training programs, but the companies are very, very effective at ensuring that these training programs are funded by the federal government. And there are a range of number of these. Around the announcement of the Principal Report, at several junctures of time over the last 6 or 7 years, there's been a whole series of federal government announcements of special training programs to train people. One of the things that often the problems with these models is often that you don't have the requisite skills to enter the training program. So it doesn't really do much good to say that we're going to provide 100 places for First Nations students in engineering if you don't have people who have the requisite science and math skills, or you don't provide the actual training and support in math and sciences. And so what the government can therefore live up to its agreement over training people by offering this, and that becomes its measure of success is independent of whether people actually enter the training programs. Oftentimes, though, they tend to be heavy machinery-operated things, and there's been a number of success with moving people into heavy operators, but the model is, and this is quite interesting, so take a gentleman, and they're often men, there's a few women have gone through these programs, majority are men so far, trained to run a heavy piece of equipment, might be a heavy-duty loader of some sort, or an excavator, some kind of large truck, and then the idea is to provide them with access and to bidding, so it's involvement to the market economy. So fund the capital cost in purchasing a large dump truck to use to then subcontract the movement of rock on Ridley Island, which is part of the Prince Rupert Port Authority expansion. And so then you set them up initially with a few couple of things, and then you say, here, from there you can go to grow your company and get more bids in other places. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Typically, the way a market economy works is you start with about 100 independent operators, and at the end of a decade or so, you probably have two or three big operations and maybe a couple of independent operators who are subcontracted to the big operators. And if you take a look at our construction trades right now, that's essentially the way it works, is a sequence of subcontractor to subcontractor to subcontractor, where no one is actually, well, not no one is the wrong word to say, where few people are actually directly employed by the contractor. So these are the models of the solutions, and it's focusing upon using market mechanisms and individual allocations. One other interesting thing, I took a look, this is on the Heisler page, and I know it's almost the same in many of the more corporate-oriented First Nations communities, the nature of the consultants that are publicly listed, which is also interesting, because not always are they listed. Very oftentimes public consultants, or not public consultants, private consultants working for First Nations or corporations are not necessarily listed. You often have to go to the different consultant web pages and see who their clients are. So you go to, say, an environmental assessment firm, and they'll very often say, oh, look, we do work for First Nations, and they'll list the First Nations. And then to really check that, you have to double check with the First Nations to see if what the work they did, if it did happen, which is part of the research plan to do. But here we have for Haisla, they have a, Cameron, let's take E3 Consulting. E3 Consulting is an engineering and environmental major projects development company, internationally based, but with an office in Vancouver. Zim Zetzenbauer, RA Capital Advisor, San Diego. Elliot Peters, RA Capital Advisor, San Diego. Gary Lee, Communications and Government Relations, Vancouver. That's a lobbyist that also does sort of PR work as well as arranges meetings with people. There's a whole kind of field of employment where, and it's not just for First Nations, it's across the board, where there are people who maybe work for government, had a brief time in government as an elected official or something like that, who then facilitate and set up meetings. And the idea of these meetings is try to help arrange a business deal of some sort. And so there's a kind of interesting kind of facilitator set up in the corporate world, and this is one of them. Then you've got two lawyers, from the Burke Doss Remedios law firm, and then you've got Donovan Aboriginal Law. I didn't check the first company, but typically First Nations these days because of the necessities of these agreements, have corporate lawyers as well as Aboriginal rights and title lawyers, and might even have employment standards type lawyers on contract for them. But this is only possible if you have this kind of cash coming through these economic benefit agreements. Best I can tell, I think Haisla, and they're not unusual in this kind of heavy industrial development zone, has at least five or six major joint ventures, plus a range of smaller ones. Gitgat, for example, has publicly acknowledged, which is Hartley Bay down the coast of the Himalta-Dundas-Douglas Channel, where the tankers go by, has a number of joint ventures. Some are benefit agreements with, like, King Pacific Lodge, which is a high-end recreational fishing lodge. If you guys check it, it's a beautiful place in the world to go, but I seem to recall last time I checked, it's around $1,500 a day. It includes five-star meals a day, plus guaranteed you get your limits and every species that you're interested in catching in that area. But they have an arrangement with them. They also had an arrangement with a logging firm, a so-called truck logger, which I think the guy's firm has about $100 million annual turn through. Also, with David Suzuki Foundation, they have an economic benefit arrangement with that, though they don't call it that. I'm using that language for it. And then with some of the gas and oil companies that are moving through in the same way that just what every other community is, but these to provide the capacity to do the research. Because there's a lot of research being done into the economic, through the environmental assessment processes. Whale watching. This is an area where there's one of the biggest growths of whales. I'm not saying whale. They're actually looking at the impact of the large shipping traffic through these areas where there's tons and tons of whales that have just bloomed in population over the last 15, 20 years or so. And the sense is that these large ships running through there will very much disturb this area, which right now is probably one of the quietest marine scapes in BC. Because there's hardly any traffic to speak of except small boat traffic, very little heavy industrial traffic there. These kind of studies cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to do them at any rigorous level. And so what the First Nations have done, which is part of these benefit agreements, and this is the kind of powerful, interesting side, where I've been talking about some of the negative sides so far, is that it shifts the capacity and control over the actual research into the First Nations community. And as long as that's controlled and managed by the community itself and doesn't just become another outsourcing of a contracting out job, it provides amazing opportunities for taking control over and access to one's own territory. And that's a really positive possibility. And as long as people can negotiate these agreements so that they don't compel certain restrictions on the type of research, then it's okay. I have more to say, but you know, I'm just going to highlight this, and I'm going to speak for about two or three more minutes, and then we'll pick up with this next day and talk about this idea here. But there's an article from 2010 that's really worth reading if you kind of jump over the sociological theory on power, which is interesting, but a little bit not particularly well done, from my perspective, unless you already know the theoretical argument they're talking about. But the key point is that this powerful, or just plain powerful, by Ken Caron and Naomi Krogman, and it's in a journal called Organization and Environment. It's from 2010. They do a very, very nice summary of everything they could find to date about impact benefit agreements. And then they talk about this idea of the kind of neutral effect, the assumption that both parties, government or First Nation proponent, come to the table with equal footing. And that's the kind of industry standard, and that it's focused on outputs. How many employment hours, how many contract dollars, degree of business opportunities. So they look at that, and then they explore the extent to which does this really address these things. And so I'll summarize this now, and then we'll talk in more detail. But here we have one of the things that happens with these agreements typically is yet again further increased social differentiation. It's not unreasonable when you see that you have differential access to the mechanisms of negotiation. That's a very polite way of saying that sometimes political leadership takes advantage of their position and earns more than perhaps one feels they should. You have confidentiality of these agreements, which leads to hiding details, which actually does a couple of things. It contributes to internal social differentiation, but it also undermines the community's ability to negotiate with the companies, because you don't know what your neighbor is negotiating with the same company. Of course, they might tell you, oh, we've done this, are we doing the same to you that we've done for everybody else? And then you go and talk to Joe, who happens to be your cousin, and says, well, actually, oh, this is what they gave us. And so you get a little bit of that, but basically that information sharing is a violation of the confidentiality agreement, which could cause both parties to lose. So there's a whole range in which it inhibits the First Nations' capacity to properly negotiate on their own behalf, and it also allows for an inequitable distribution internally, because people, even in the community, really end up not knowing what's in these agreements. They're often after the fact. It's felt to be a last chance effort. The companies, like in mining, there's no consultation while they're doing exploration. And in fact, a lot of the exploration you can do now sitting in an office studying charts, diagrams, and satellite pictures, things like that. You don't even have to go on the ground anymore. You just fly over with your LIDAR and you can then study that data and extract information. File your claims online, then go to your capital markets to get investment, and by the time you turn up to begin the impact benefit agreement, you've already invested a heck of a lot of money. You don't really have an incentive, and for the First Nation field, they really can't stop the project. They have a last chance is really just to try to get some benefits for the community out of something that really looks like it's going to go ahead. which then leads to this notion I described before, assimilation via the marketplace. So we'll pick up this, but I also want to next day talk about some of the positive benefits that are different than the standard industry-led positive benefits. And also, I want to talk about how different types of negotiations that don't accept the market individualism of the current regime can actually do something differently that's perhaps, from my perspective, lead to more positive outcomes. So that's what we'll talk about on Wednesday. All right.